Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the life and long career of one Ernest Borgnine. The Screen Actors Guild just gave him their Life Achievement Award 6 days after his 94th birthday. Post-punk icons Gang of Four return with Content, their first studio record in 16 years. And we remember the life and music of Country Music Hall of Fame singer Charlie Louvin. But first,
this week and next, we're featuring a series of stories about how there's no longer one dominant cultural conversation in the U.S. The explosion of internet outlets and TV channels means it's harder for any one star to get everyone's attention. Today, NPR's Netta Ulibi reports on one man who's trying to figure out how to dominate across platforms.
Steve Harvey did everything he could to be as famous as someone like Bill Cosby. He hosted Showtime at the Apollo. He starred in two sitcoms.
Well, hello, Mr. Highwire.
My name ain't no Highwire.
Harvey has written two New York Times best-selling books, and millions of people have seen him host the game show Family Feud.
Let's clear the board, Brenda.
And Harvey remains a formidable presence on the stand-up circuit, as seen in the documentary The Original Kings of Comedy. But the cornerstone of Steve Harvey's fame today is the nationally syndicated radio and TV show that airs in 64 markets.
Good morning, everybody. You are listening to The Voice. Come on, dig me now, one and only Steve Harvey.
Every weekday at dawn, at 5 o'clock in the morning, Harvey makes a grand entrance at his Atlanta production studio.
There he is.
His production staff goes a little nuts. It's an office ritual. The makeup artists start a cheer. Harvey's show reaches 7 million people, but Harvey knows millions more have never heard of him. After the show, he takes an elevator 7 stories above the studio to an opulent, wood-paneled office with floor-to-ceiling windows. He steeples his fingers and says he wants to leave show business.
I want my fame that I paid for, that it cost me so dearly to have. I want it to pay off.
Harvey wants to leverage his fame into entrepreneurship. Men's suits, grocery stores, a dating website, energy-efficient light bulbs. He says it's protection for when people tire of him.
Throw me off to the side, dish me off like I'm a dish rag, throw me in the sink. No, man, I'm wringing this puppy out. We're getting all the moisture out of this fame that's so difficult to acquire and costs so much to attain and maintain. You're not throwing me away.
As we talk, Harvey's eyes constantly flick from his heavy carved desk and towards a flat-screen TV. It does nothing but flash the comedian's long-term goals, like listen to the voice, stay prayerful.
I want to become one of the premier motivational speakers. I'm going to break out of the entertainment world, become one of the leading businessmen. My yearly income goal is to make $250 million a year. I'm nowhere close to that, but that's the goal.
Steve Harvey grew up in the projects in Cleveland. He's a workaholic who started doing stand-up when he was 27. For years, he ground out gigs in clubs across the United States.
If you name me the city, I can without anything tell you how to get there.
Okay. Montgomery, Alabama.
Man, you take 85 over to Montgomery, you catch 65, and you go south to the 10. If you ask me how to get to Kansas, I'm going to tell you from here to take 20, go up to 40, take 40 across till it turns into 70, and you'll hit Kansas. Well, I can get you to Vermilion, South Dakota from here.
But Harvey's had more trouble finding a roadmap to a multiracial fan base. His sitcom, The Steve Harvey Show, ran for 6 years. It got decent ratings, NAACP awards, but it never found Cosby-like traction beyond black audiences. When he got a book deal based on relationship advice he gives during his show, his publishers tried to keep him in that niche.
They were convinced at HarperCollins that this was for black women. And when I sent the book in, they were putting stuff in it like, sisters, let me tell y'all, and black women gotta stay together. Whoa, I didn't say that. No, take all that out.
Men are men and women are women, says Harvey. So his books are for everyone.
I think he does a fabulous job of getting people talking.
Tanya Ladipo is a psychotherapist. Her clients are mostly African American. It surprised her how often her appointments start with a question.
Did you hear Steve Harvey's show this morning?
That's their in, a way to start talking about their problems. Ladipo does not always agree with Harvey's advice, but she says, take him as a comedian, not a mental health professional.
At a moment when relationship success is critical to Steve Harvey's brand, an ex-wife has been publicly unhappy about their divorce. On Harvey's show, he discussed his mistakes with his on-air sidekicks.
I done got it wrong a lot of times. Hey, man, I got a divorce. Hey, man, I stepped out on my girl.
But then Harvey started talking about his upcoming national tour with Kirk Franklin, one of gospel's biggest stars. It's called the Ain't Nobody Perfect Tour. Harvey promised his co-hosts and his audience the tour would make them laugh, not chuckle.
What's a chuckle, Steve? What's a laugh?
Laugh is when you hit the people you roll with.
Hitting the people you roll with. In a fragmented media culture, that's pretty much the definition of success. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Ernest Borgnine played tough guys in many Hollywood classics, including From Here to Eternity and The Wild Bunch. Of course, he won an Oscar for playing nice in the 1955 film Marty. Certainly had a hit TV series, McHale's Navy, in the 1960s. Ernest Borgnine celebrated his 94th birthday last Monday, and he's still a working actor, Pat Dowell reports.
Tough guy Ernest Borgnine was set on his career path by his mom. He grew up in Connecticut, the son of Italian immigrants, and went into the Navy shortly after high school. When he got out at the end of World War II, he was looking for something to do, and his mother suggested acting.
Me, an actor? Are you kidding? But when she said it, it suddenly, I don't know, I looked up and I saw that golden light and I said, Mom, that's what I'm going to be.
He used his GI benefits to study acting and drew on his decade-long stint in the Navy for the first memorable movie role he played, a sadistic stockade sergeant in the Army drama From Here to Eternity.
I based Fatso Judson on a fellow that I knew in the Navy, a bosun mate that I liked him, but he was a hard character to get along with. He always had a cigar in his mouth. Now, if the cigar was down, kind of relaxing in his mouth, that was fine. But if that cigar stuck straight out, watch yourself.
Fatso Judson taunts and threatens a private, played by Frank Sinatra, after a barroom brawl.
Tough monkey. Guys like you end up in the stockade sooner or later. Someday you walk in, I'll be waiting. I'll show you a couple of things.
He does, and Borgnine was known thereafter as the guy who killed Frank Sinatra and helped Sinatra win his 1953 Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. 2 years later, it was Borgnine's turn. He won Best Actor for a role reversal in Marty, playing a good guy, the shy New Yorker who works in a butcher shop and knows too much about loneliness.
All my brothers-in-law, they're always telling me what a good-hearted guy I am. You don't get to be good-hearted by accident. You get kicked around long enough, you get to be a real professor of pain. I know exactly how you feel. And I also want you to know I'm having a very good time with you right now and really enjoying myself. But you see, you're not such a dog as you think you are.
I'm having a very good time, too.
So there you are. So I guess I'm not such a dog as I think I am.
Marty has to stick out. It's so indelible. But with a person like Ernest Borgnine, I find myself almost obliged to experience him as a body of work and a continuing one.
Sean Penn directed Borgnine in a segment that was part of a collection of short films called September 11, about how the terrorist attacks on that date affected people around the world. Penn and Borgnine became friends.
Contrary to the kind of generational mythology that actors of that earlier generation are not adept at improvisation and so on, he was not only adept at it, he was very spontaneous and very game. And so in many ways, he became a second writer on the piece.
Borgnine played a New York widower, immersed in his grief to the exclusion of all else, still talking to his absent wife, laying out her dress each day, even as the towers fall.
Something summery. Oh, yes, this is it. Oh, my goodness.
But Borgnine is best known for the smug ferocity of his great villains. The bully in the 1954 cult western Johnny Guitar, who knifes his roommate in the back, and then complains.
Some people just won't listen.
And Shaq, the Depression-era railroad brute who delights in kicking hobos off his train in the 1973 drama Emperor of the North. But these characters are a mystery to the man who made them unforgettable.
I haven't the slightest idea where I got them. As a matter of fact, I used to go home to my wife and I'd say, honey, am I really that kind of a person? Am I really that bad to come up with a character like Shaq? I don't know. It just didn't register with me because I found myself doing things that I had never done in my life and wouldn't do them, you know?
But he's also played superheroes. Ernest Borgnine is the voice of Mermaid Man, who lives in retirement with sidekick Barnacle Boy in SpongeBob SquarePants.
I told you I'm not hungry, Mermaid Man.
Nonsense, Barnacle Boy. We've got to keep up our strength for the fight against evil.
Borgnine has no favorite among his movies, he insists, although there is one that he admits is close to his heart, Sam Peckinpah's 1969 classic, The Wild Bunch.
I think The Wild Bunch was about the most fun for me and the one that stands out and more in my mind than anything else. It was the last of the great westerns, I think.
Borgnine played an aging bandit alongside William Holden, trying to understand why an old comrade-in-arms has gotten out of prison by agreeing to lead a railroad posse against the bunch.
They got Freddy. Looks like he's hit pretty bad.
Damn that Deke Thornton to hell.
What would you do in his place? He gave his word.
Gave his word to a railroad.
It's his word! That ain't what counts! It's who you give it to!
Ernest Borgnine says he enjoys every acting job. Sean Penn says that's a key to Borgnine's personal and professional longevity.
He's that unusual creature we call a happy person, and I think that does a lot for the health.
But one thing that Borgnine doesn't enjoy is watching his finished work.
I just don't like my puss on the screen.
But he watches anyway.
I say, dummy, you could have done better. Listen, it's the only way you learn, you know.
And at 94, Ernest Borgnine is still reading scripts, still acting, and still learning. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
Country music legend Charlie Louvin has died. He and his brother Ira found success in the 1950s and 60s as the Louvin Brothers, and they were a huge influence on musicians well beyond country music. NPR's Joel Rose has this appreciation.
Before their close harmonies influenced the Everly Brothers, the Byrds, or anyone else, the Louvin Brothers were a gospel act.
The family who prayed will never be parted. Their circle in heaven unbroken shall stand.
Charlie Louvin told WHYY's Fresh Air in 2003 that the brothers' vocal style came easily.
Us being raised together, if it was obvious that the song was going to get too high for me to sing in a certain place, my brother just automatically take that high lead, and I would do the low harmony. We didn't have to step on each other's foot or wink or bump shoulders to do this. It was just something that you knew was going to happen.
Charlie and Ira Loudermilk were born in Alabama. Country music historian Nolan Porterfield says they drew on the music of their church and on an earlier generation of duet singing.
They took from here and there and yon and came up with this just beautiful vocal sound, just harmony. In my estimation, it's never been equal.
While the Louvin Brothers never gave up gospel music, they found their greatest success when they crossed over into mainstream country in 1955. But gradually, Ira Louvin's drinking and temper drove the brothers apart. They broke up in 1963, and 2 years later, Ira was killed in a car crash. Charlie Louvin had some hits on his own, but in the late 1960s, Graham Parsons introduced the Louvin Brothers' music to the Byrds and a new generation of fans.
He was like one of those Old Testament figures to me. Their songs just almost felt like as if they came out of the hymn books, even the country ones.
Country singer Marty Stewart played mandolin on Louvin's 2007 comeback album.
Just singing alongside him, I went, boy, it is deep in there. He has nuances, and he understands a lyric, and he understands where to put the emotion on top of a lyric. So he was a master.
Even into his 80s, Charlie Louvin kept performing for younger audiences in rock clubs and at the Bonnaroo Music Festival. But for all the shows he played without Ira by his side, Charlie Louvin said he always expected his brother to join him on the choruses.
When it comes time for the harmonies to come in, I will move to my left, because my brother and I always just used one microphone. And so you had to share the mic. And I even today, I will move over to the left to give the harmony room, knowing in my mind that there's no harmony standing on my right. But it's just old habits are hard to break.
I still hear you off in the distance, your sweet harmony.
Charlie Louvin died this morning of complications from pancreatic cancer. He was 83 years old. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
There'll never be another, 'cause you can't beat family. I know you're up there singing.
The British band Gang of Four gave expression to a tumultuous period in Great Britain, a time in the late 70s and early 80s when high unemployment and the unraveling of the welfare state would usher in the rise of Margaret Thatcher and her free market revolution.
It's not made for great men. It's not made for great men. It's not made for great men. It's not made for great men.
Punk rock, glam rock, they were on the way out, and political rock and roll was on the way in. Gang of Four never became a huge commercial success, but many bands today consider the group one of the most influential rock acts. More than three decades since they first burst onto the scene, Gang of Four, led by frontman John King, is back with a record that sounds as urgent and fresh as ever. And John King is in our studios in London. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
What can I say? Welcome back. I mean, this is your first studio record in 16 years, and wow, I mean, there is no mistaking right off the bat with this first track. This is a Gang of Four album. Can you tell me what this record is about?
When Andy and I started writing the songs
this
that
is Andy
ended up on
Andy Gill, your guitarist.
Andy Gill, yeah. We had, a few years ago, been enticed back into playing some of the old classics, and we toured those songs for a while, and it was almost inevitable that we would start kicking around new ideas, because I'm like most musicians, I get bored quite quickly.
So you were kind of looking to kind of update your classic sound from the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, I wouldn't say update it so much. It's just that that's the sound that we have develop for ourselves. And I think once you've got something which you think is yours and that you own, you're sort of naturally, I suppose, likely to go into those same territories.
Hey, John King, your music has always been lauded for its sharp social commentary, and there's some of that on this record, a lot of that on this record, and particularly in the song You'll Never Pay for the Farm.
You Never Pay for the Farm was the first track that we'd written. This is about 2 years old, this song. There had been the catastrophic collapse in the financial world caused by these gambling criminals who've made gigantic profits from other people's misery and expected us all to fund their gambling. And this is one of those songs where you've got an element of reverse engineering about it, because the line, "You'll never pay for the farm," was something I thought was interesting. And soldiers in combat since the Second World War have often used the phrase when someone got killed, "He bought the farm." And what we all struggle to do as we go along our lives is to pay for the farm. You know, it's one of those phrases, you know, once you pay for the farm, you can then pay for your other luxuries or whatever. And of course, the irony since the collapse of finance is that we all spend the whole time on this drudging treadmill to pay for the farm, but the only time you'll get to pay for the farm is when you bought the farm. You can't regret what you get. You can't get back what you bet. You can't divorce from your fate. You're lying drunk in the wake.
I'm speaking with John King. He's one of the founding members of the band Gang of Four. Their new record is called Content. John King, can I ask you about Gang of Four lyrics going way back?
Yep.
So many of your lyrics have been parsed over for years. I mean, there's the track Return the Gift. You sing,
please send me evenings and weekends.
There's a line from the song Anthrax.
And I feel like a beetle on its back.
Go along with what? And there's no way for me to get up.
And on Natural's Not In It, you sang,
the problem of a leisure.
These lines mean different things to different people. And when you read people who write about Gang of Four and about your music as a reaction to Thatcherism or sort of the early 80s Britain with its high unemployment and the unraveling of the unions, does that make sense to you? Do you think, yeah, that's exactly what we were trying to capture?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the things that I was interested in, I remember when I was 15, I got incredibly excited when I found some grubby old book in a second-hand bookshop about the revolution in Paris in 1968. There was a picture which I still cherish, which is a photograph of, I think, for some kind of perfume, and a very glamorous-looking woman on this poster. And someone had written on it in French, I know I'm exploiting you, but I'm not doing it on purpose. And I got terribly excited by the fact, and using this as a situationist described, this dérive concept, where you can change the meaning of things by the label. And that predated Thatcher's arrival by a few years. And when I was at university, the things that I was very interested in was this approach. And I wondered how one could play around with some of these sorts of ideas in music. That said, there is no better time to be a musician when you have a reactionary and oppressive government who are trying to grind the faces of the poor and the underprivileged into the dirt, like we have at the moment in our country.
A lot of bands, as you know, have pointed to Gang of Four as a major influence. R.E.M., Nirvana, The Killers. And I want to play a sample of some of the bands that say that they have been inspired by your sound. Take a listen to this.
Take me out! Can you feel intensified? Can you feel the lows?
That last band is Block Party. We heard from Franz Ferdinand, the Future Heads, and a few other bands. Pretty amazing when you hear that. What do you think when you hear a whole bunch of modern bands sounding a lot like Gang of Four from 1979?
I think it's a great privilege to have somehow or other inspired other musicians to make great music. I think, you know, pompously comparing ourselves to Led Zeppelin, but I mean, Led Zeppelin probably feel the same, that the infinitely varied use of the drum intro to Black Dog by every hip-hop band in history must be, you know, quite fun, you know, to think that there was something there that was so vibrant and in itself that it was worth other musicians quoting, and that's a tremendous compliment.
When you play shows today, when Gang of Four play shows today, a huge part of your fan base is made up of people who weren't even born when your first record was released in 1978. What do you make of that?
It's marvelous, really. When 5 years ago I was enticed into playing again, the first show that we did was at Shepherd's Bush Empire, which sold out quite quickly. And I went down there on the London Underground with my 15-year-old daughter, who was coming along to the show, who'd never seen one of our shows, of course. And we got off our bit of the underground, and of the next two compartments of the train emptied out, and it was, I don't know, 150 kids, all in her year from her school, all going to see me play. And they were all amazed that her dad was this character. And I was very entertained by it. And I think it's because we are an oppositional band. I think people are sick of the commercial bands, the karaoke acts you see on American Idol and X Factor. And I've always had the great luxury of never being commercially successful, so we can do what we like.
That's John King. He's the frontman for the legendary band Gang of Four. Their new album is called Content. If you'd like to hear a few tracks, they're at our website, nprmusic.org. John King, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Bye.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.